The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Monday, March 6th, 2017, from Slate. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca, and I have a theory. Like the authors of a big New York Times piece who looked into the North Korean missile program, I've been crunching the numbers. I've been calculating telemetry, trajectory, failure rate. Now let's review some of what we know. This is from last week.
South Korea says North Korea has fired three ballistic missiles into the sea off its east coast.
And this just a couple weeks before.
North Korea firing off a ballistic missile into the Sea of Japan.
Now this goes back to 2015.
North Korea fired two short-range missiles into the sea on Monday in possible protest at the annual South Korea-U.S. military drill, which it says is provocative and pushes the two Koreas toward war.
Okay, add it all up. I think the conclusion is hard to avoid. North Korea is at war with the sea. They want to attack King Neptune himself. For years of insolence, isolation, wetness, they said a war against water could not be won. We would never know lest it be waged. And Kim Jong-un is the man to attack the sea. Now, the Times correspondents, they came up with a different theory. They said that North Korea's failure rate, which is in the high 80s with these missiles, and it's a type of missile that failed at about 13% with the Soviets, can be explained by something else. Well, first of all, like good journalists, they said it could be a number of things. Could be welding. Yes, it could be that the North Koreans were bad at welding. All right, here's your problem right here. You're doing the glass metal arc welding. What you want to do is the tungsten inert glass welding. Common mistake. But no, what's really happening, quite clearly, is that the U.S. is using sophisticated cyber attacks to screw with North Korean missiles. They send one of ours to the hospital. We send one of theirs to the morgue. They tank opening weekend box office for a Franco Rogan vehicle. We destroy their missiles. That's the U.S. military way. And that's how you get Kim Jong-un. Okay, but it may not be. It may not be for long. Under the auspices of a president who denigrates our own intelligence community and says we're so far behind in the cyber. Well, here's to hoping Donald Trump will treat the North Koreans carefully, will embolden our smartest minds to undermine them through technology that he doesn't understand, and will not unnecessarily provoke the Hermit Kingdom into a dangerous coming out party. Or, you know, backup plan. We hire a 400-pound guy on his bed to do our bidding for us. On the show today, I spiel about the tap, 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 drip, drip, drip out of Trump Tower. There were three taps in there, but I think six P's, going by his spelling. But first, whenever a guest comes by, I ask, is there anything you'd like to drink? Can I hang up your jacket? Oh, it's in the Smithsonian. That's right. Henry Winkler is by to talk about his new book and to teach us all a valuable lesson about the true meaning of cool. This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way, or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're not going to do anything stupid, are we?
Don't you hurt him!
Nobody's going to hurt anybody. We're all going to be like three little Fonzies here. And what's Fonzie like? Come on, Yolanda, what's Fonzie like?
Cool.
What?
Cool.
Correctamundo. And that's what we're going to be. We're going to be cool.
Although Fonzie is not only cool, Fonzie, or Henry Winkler, who played Fonzie famously, is author of the multi-series Hank Zipser books. Hank Zipser is a boy with dyslexia, and we have traced him, Henry, through how many books now?
34.
34 books. So this one that I have before me, which I think the subtitle is Always Watch Out for the Flying Potato Salad, which
right.
It sounds better in the original Latin. But
You know what? I couldn't put the original Latin on there because I would never be able to read it.
So these books come from...
My life.
Your life.
Yes.
And when did you know the word dyslexic?
I knew it when I was 31.
Wow.
My stepson, who came into my life when he was 4, was in the third grade. We had him tested, and everything that they said about him was true about me.
And did you say, wait a minute?
I said I was pissed off.
Yeah, I wish I
said I was angry because I got humiliated. I felt bad about myself. I was punished. I was grounded, all for no reason.
Yeah. Well, a lot of this is your parents, and they were
stricter. Well, because it's hereditary.
Yeah. But your dad was this multilinguist, brilliant
yes.
mathematician.
Yeah, it must have skipped him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or
maybe he was so short it went right above his head, you know?
So what coping mechanisms did you employ?
Humor.
Mm-hmm.
I was the class clown. And because I was so embarrassed all the time, I would make people laugh and I could win the dance contests at the school dances.
Yeah. I think that came into play one time. Joni was bumped off the cheerleading squad.
That's right.
And you won the dance contest.
Well, in the sixth grade, my parents took me to see the Musayev Russian folk dancing. And it was so powerful. And I was so moved by it. I taught myself a bastardized version of the Kazatsky.
Yes.
So I did that in Temple.
Yes.
And I did it at school dances.
Yes.
And then I did it on Happy Days.
Were you ever in a production of Fiddler where they do that?
I was never in a production of Fiddler. Now I could probably play the horse. You know. But no, I never was.
What about memorizing scripts? I mean, you got your MFA from Yale
in
1970.
Did. Yes.
That must have been hard.
It was hard because at that time, having no sense of self, it was very hard for me to focus.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard for me to just give over to the script because I was always so worried all the time. And it has taken me... basically, up until now, to become the actor I dreamt of being when I first started.
And you think the dyslexia was...
I do. I think that I was so not in charge of my own self. I was the bowl of Jell-O before you put it in the icebox to congeal. I was shaking all the time.
So here I am talking to the Fonz, but I want to talk about the font because I never knew this until I read the foreword of this book.
The
font is amazing.
That's right. And I never knew about the font.
So this is new. The font that you use in the book.
This is brand new and it's never been used in America
before.
Tell
us about this.
It was devised by a dad in Holland for his children who are dyslexic. I believe he himself is dyslexic. What he has done is the C, the opening of the C is farther apart than most C's. The ink is heavier. The words are weighted. The extension of the F is longer. The dissension of the G is longer. And he put together this font that made it easier for the reluctant reader.
Yes.
To join the eye and the page and have them be friends.
And I have to say that 100 out of 100 readers who did not know this and weren't dyslexic would in no way say there's something weird about this font. It just looks like it's a little whimsical and
it's
appropriate
whimsical.
For a children's book.
Right.
But that's good. That's who
but
should be
when you
this.
Look at it.
Yeah.
you think, oh my gosh, this is really easy to read. Mm-hmm. And especially since Here's Hank is for the beginning reader, it's first, second, third grade, for the reluctant reader who thinks I can't do it, this helps them.
Are there other things that I, as a non-dyslexic person, don't even think about? There must be little changes that could help the dyslexic person more than, you know, I've ever even considered.
Understanding them and not making fun of them.
Sure.
If I were to go into a store and I paid for a piece of pizza with paper money, I would not know how much change I get back, nor would I know how to count the change in my hand before I left the store and used a calculator.
I know you've transacted most of your business in America, but in England where or Europe, where the money is different size, different color, is that any easier?
No.
No.
It is not, because the number is the same.
Yeah. Once you have it.
Now, I will say that the money in Europe is way more beautiful.
Yes.
Yes.
And it used to be way more valuable, but now, not really.
Well, you know, but even just, we have such mundane money.
Although I do have to say, with the euro, you know, they have bridges and mostly bridges, some other forms of transport or infrastructure. But the point was, it can't be a real bridge. It just has to sort of symbolize, because if it was in one country, it would alienate that country. Yeah. So it's kind of an ecumenical currency.
So from the planet Orc, it could be a bridge.
Yes. And there was a Happy Days reference. So this gets us into a few of the questions I've always wanted
to
ask.
Ahead. I'm here. Okay, go.
Do you have a kinship with Jaleel White, who played Urkel?
I don't. Except that I understand how difficult it is to play a character, have such wonderful success, have such a great fan base, and then you are only known for one character.
And Gomer Pyle is in the same field, where they start off as a minor character on a show and immediately they become the main
Absolutely.
Focus. Now, this gets me to my next question.
Yes.
Do you bemoan?
Do you know Jaleel?
No, I've not met him. I know he's good at basketball.
But, there you go.
There's the Fonzie Urkel. And they're both great names, too, Fonzie and Urkel. And Gomer Pyle.
And produced by the same team.
Is this true?
Tom Miller, Bob Boyette, Eddie Milkus.
Yeah. Was part of the becoming a different character, was being a tough character, a tough guy?
No, I don't think it mattered.
It did,
No. Now, certainly the Fonz was everybody I wanted to be.
Yeah.
And I never was, you know. I was never in that kind of control. I never had that kind of social life. I was never the apple of my, circles, of friends. But I don't know even if that sentence made sense.
The apple of the circle of friends?
Yes, the apple of their eye.
The apple of the eye. I was never a leader. Yes.
You know? I was always the core or the stem. So it took me a while to relax into being Henry.
You mentioned character actor. And it's a crude distinction, but often a character actor is a really good actor who doesn't have the matinee idol looks. But as the Fonz, you're this sex symbol. And then once they cast you as the Fonz, you become the Fonz. And I guess everyone agrees, this is a good-looking, sexy guy.
Okay, but I think that that the good looks was not really, I was not, classically great-looking. I think that they liked the character, ergo I became good-looking.
Right, and everyone on the show agrees, this is the guy that
I was better-looking than a lot of people on the show.
Yeah, that's very important, next to
Anson Williams.
Yeah, well, he was a good-looking one. I was Ralph Nauf.
Ralph Nauf is very handsome.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Fonzie's inability to say love. This is...
Wrong.
To say...
Wrong.
Oh, to say he's wrong.
Yes.
Yes.
I could say, hey, listen, I want to tell you something. I love this interview. But I could not say.
Could not admit.
I could not admit that I was...
Okay.
That I was...
So here's my question.
What?
Does Happy Days invent that?
I want to do the rest of this interview as the Fonz.
That'd be okay.
Okay, man.
All right. So, by the way, where did a guy from Milwaukee get this accent?
It was very simple. He was born in Milwaukee and he studied in New York City.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Where? Which section?
I would say the Bronx.
Yeah.
That's where Gary Marshall came from.
So
his real name was Marshallelli.
Yeah. No, yeah. I know.
Right. Get to the question.
Not saying wrong.
Right.
Was that invented? Is this an old vaudeville bit?
It was. I don't know.
Yeah.
I do not know that. The writers, we had many, many writers.
Yes.
And they came up with this, and that's what I did. I couldn't eat liver.
Right.
I couldn't
you
say
you were ashamed of admitting it. You didn't want Richie to divulge this consequence of his high school reporting.
It was my kryptonite.
I remember that one.
Right.
But
there's a great episode where Ron Howard holds it up to me and says, come on, take a bite.
Liver is pretty much gone. Kids no longer.
I used to have liver. My parents were very short Germans, and we had liver and onions and mashed potatoes and tongue and boiled potatoes.
Yeah.
With brown mustard.
Oh, my God. Health food. Yeah.
I want it. Yeah.
I was in a German restaurant yesterday. I asked for vegetables. They gave me boiled celery.
Is that true?
Yes.
But what about Spätzle?
Yeah, Spätzle.
Hello. Yes. Yeah.
So the question, though, with Wrong is as much as we decry the three-camera before studio audience, I get the sense.
Wait a minute. Who's decrying it?
Yeah, some people do.
They do?
Sophisticates.
Sophisticates.
This is so-called sophisticates. I get the sense.
Oh, take your A-frames and get out of here.
That you played off the crowd, and when they were loving it, it became its own thing because of the reaction. If you hadn't gotten that live reaction, maybe you wouldn't have.
I don't know
like
that that's true, but I had a wonderful time with the audience.
Yeah.
The audience gives you an energy that it's unlike anything. Like doing theater. I love going to and being in a play.
There were times when the audience would laugh, maybe at not exactly the part you wanted them to, and you'd give them a look, and it would stay on camera.
Well, because you know what? They screwed up the timing.
Yeah,
timing is everything.
But you give them a look in character, like Fonzie going, what are you doing?
What are you doing?
Yeah.
Calm down.
Now, what did you do? I know that Seinfeld had this problem with Kramer would come in the room, the audience would clap, and they wanted to get rid of this. So eventually they said, no more clapping.
We didn't do that.
No. You indulged in it.
No.
Hey, you know what I'm going to do to you? I'm going to pop you one so you'll stop playing games.
Now, I would let him go unless you want to make medical history. Good choice.
Very nice. Give me a bitch.
And then Chachi came in the room and there was more clapping.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, you only had to write half a show. It's the height of your
popularity. You know what they did? They only wrote half a script for Robin Williams. It was scene. Robin will do something here. Scene. Everybody had lines, but Robin.
Your answer about knowing the Urkel experience and typecasting.
Right.
Do you celebrate? Do you bemoan? What do you think about the death of monoculture? You know, the idea that there were three networks, we all knew what was going on. It was very hard for you to escape that role because that's all we had.
Yeah, but you know what? I've been able to do all of this wonderful stuff. I'm going to do a new show with Bill Hader on HBO.
Oh, good.
We did a wonderful show where I traveled the world with George Foreman, Bill Shatner, and Terry Bradshaw, and Jeff Dye, the stand-up comic.
Yeah.
We're going again.
I saw you guys in a dojo.
That's
at
right.
At some point.
That's right.
Yes.
And we're now going again on that trip. I got to do Arrested Development. I got to do Children's Hospital. Now, you cannot tell those people.
Yeah.
Brilliantly funny people. I did not understand more than two jokes in about 7 years. I had no idea what I was saying.
You were obsessed with jetpacks.
There's nothing wrong with that. How about that? Was that a great episode?
Yes.
That was amazing. Not good on the scrotum, but very funny.
So, now that you have tenure, what are you going to do?
I'm going to do what anybody in my position would do.
Please say what I hope you're going to say.
I'm going to design the world's first consumer jetpack.
Yeah, that was totally it. That is exactly what I wanted to do. Whoa. Okay, now I hope you say.
You're going to help me.
Yes, that was it again. We are totally in
on the same page.
And that's a great example because this is a niche show. It's a 15-minute show.
It would never have gotten on.
But for the fracture.
That's right. Yeah. Now, what happens? If you build it, they will come. Good television, you find good television. It's word of mouth. Today you've got Catastrophe, which is, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it is incredibly funny and smart. And Rob Delaney and...
Irish couple and they have the baby.
It's incredible.
And if a network tried to put that on from an era where you couldn't...
Wouldn't have gotten
right,
on.
Right. What was the compromise with you and leather jackets?
Only if I was in a scene with my motorcycle.
Could you wear the leather?
That's
otherwise,
right.
It was too offensive to middle America.
Okay.
Yes. So we go from that
to... We just saw Goliath.
Yeah.
Okay. Unbelievable show. So if you build it, we will find it. What a lovely conversation.
I enjoyed it very much. Henry Winkler is the author of the Hank Zipser books, and the newest one is Always Watch Out for the Flying Potato Salad. Here's Hank. Thank you, Henry. Great to meet you.
Thank you.
And now the spiel. The allegation of a wiretap of the phones in Trump Tower distracted all the attention away from Jeff Sessions' recusal in the Russian election meddling case. Now, that distracted all the attention away from Trump's glorious resetting speech, which blessedly elevated his presidency from a Pinocchio presidency to real boy presidency. But that may have distracted from Trump's assertion that no one knew healthcare was hard, which probably got our eye off the ball that the fake media, CNN, New York Times, NBC, is the enemy, which perhaps caused us to overlook the Mike Flynn dismissal. But that happened in the first half of the Trump presidency. Who could remember that? The alleged wiretap, which is an allegation one simply doesn't make without serious consideration of the evidence, and the fact that you misspelled the word tap should in no way indicate that you're operating with anything less than the utmost rigor and sophistication. Oh my God, Arnold got fired from The Apprentice. Sometimes on this show, we play a game called Talk Show Karaoke, wherein I jump in and I give an answer that a guest should have given on one of the weekend talk shows. Or sometimes I pretend to be the host. But there are two reasons why karaoke isn't like real singing. One is that karaoke rewards indulgence. And there would be no way, let's say I were Senator Mark Warner and John Dickerson asked me this question, I know what my knee-jerk response would have to be.
We're at the beginnings of this. We're going to get the information we need to get to the bottom of this.
Who are you going to call?
Ghostbusters. I'd have said Ghostbusters. I'd have definitely said I was going to call Ghostbusters. But the other reason that karaoke isn't real is that sometimes the ersatz version, you know, me doing my Sunday afternoon quarterbacking, is no way an improvement on the actual version. And there was Martha Raddatz just flaying White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
The president of the United States is accusing the former president of wiretapping him.
I think that this is, again, something that if this happened, Martha, if this happened, once again, this would be the greatest abuse of power and overreach that's probably ever occurred in the executive branch.
But what about
something
these
that certainly
accusations?
Deserves
you just
to be
saying,
looked at.
If
this happened, it would have been the greatest scandal. Well, what if Chester A. Arthur moonlighted as a circus elephant? What if William McKinley and the lovely Ida Saxton McKinley dressed as a male and female moose on weekends and displayed aggressive rutting behavior? What if Lincoln shot first? If, take it Rudyard Kipling.
If you can wait and not be tired by waiting or being lied about, don't deal in lies. Or being hated, don't give way to hating. And yet don't look too good, nor talk too wise.
Well, Trump certainly doesn't look too wise, like Kipling advised. Of course, neither did Sarah Huckabee Sanders. She didn't do a great job in Trump's defense. Well, what about Breitbart? I've been on their site today. Breitbart's main argument is that the media is being dishonest in concentrating on the word tap. Not the spelling of the word tap, just the idea that the actual phones were actually tapped. Breitbart's argument is, sure, if by wiretap, Trump meant wiretap, sure, they may never prove that. But if by wiretap, what he's saying is stuff that's already been reported about Paul Manafort and Carter Page, then he is right. And other conservative sites have already been laying down the premise that Trump will be proved right because what he really meant was that Paul Manafort was being investigated, and former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort not only worked out of Trump Tower, he actually lived in Trump Tower. That is true. So once that comes out, Trump will be vindicated for alleging that Obama wiretapped Trump Tower. You know, it's just a replay of the birther controversy behind the presidential seal. This is Kenyan long-form conspiracy theory, but with all the trappings, deference, and bullying pulpit of the presidency behind him. Few people who I know lived through Trump alleging that Obama was a Kenyan and said, what this country needs is more of that. More of that kind of logic and attention to detail. We need that in the White House. But a lot of people said that. How many? All right, so I look back at the polls. Now, in the summer of 2016, and this was before Trump backed off his birther claim, NBC SurveyMonkey asked, was Obama born in America? And they found out that 8 in 10 Democrats agreed he was born in America. Far more Republicans disagreed, 41% no, than agreed, 27%. So that was pretty dispiriting. But I remember thinking, you know, it's not an insignificant portion who don't believe Obama's American, but it's pretty small. And in doing some research, I found out why I thought that. So listen to this report, 2015 CNN.
Was President Obama born in the United States? 70% of all Republicans say yes. 61%, so a smaller percentage of Trump supporters, say yes.
The vast majority of Republicans, less of a majority of Trump supporters saying, yeah, he was born in America. But I did some digging on this. It really matters how you ask the question. When pollsters asked, where was the president born, they were much more likely to get the response, America. Maybe the poll subjects thought it was like a trivia question. But when they were asked, was Obama born inside the United States or outside the United States, a large percentage of Republicans said outside the United States. Remember, there was CNN saying that 61% of Trump supporters said he was born in the United States. But that's only when they asked him, where was he born? When a different firm, PPP, in the same year, asked the same question, but this way, was President Obama born in the United States? They found among Trump supporters, the exact same number, 61%, said that Obama was not born in the United States. So we've always had this largish figure among a subset, that subset being Trump supporters. And since now voters who ID as Trump supporters and voters who ID as Republicans are virtually indistinguishable, this is where we find ourselves. Trump knows he has a built-in audience who will eagerly embrace or fall for his unfounded allegations. But this time, rather than posting a hastily shot video on YouTube, he can spur congressional investigations and he could give rise to thousands of talk show segments. And some will claim it's a distraction, but I think that's why he got into politics. Who knows? If he's ultimately held to account on this nonsense, it could be the reason he's forced out of politics, too. And that's it for today's show. The Gist was produced by Chris Berube, the leather Tuscadero of producers. Mary Wilson also produced, like Jenny Piccolo. She was often referred to in the first few seasons of this show, but became a full-fledged character as the attention switched to Joni. Steve Lickteig is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Talked about a lot in the first episode, and then never again, the Chuck Cunningham of our little gang. Andy Bowers, chief content officer of the Panoply Network. Of course, everyone refers to him as the Bows, with exception of Mrs. C, who calls him by his true first name, Arthur. The Gist, we're half Joe Camel and a third Fonzarelli. Oompuru depuru duperu, and thanks for listening. You listen to podcasts, I have proof of that. You're a living proof. And all this month, what we're doing is we're asking you to evangelize a little bit for us, but in a very practical way, one-to-one, contact. Tell a friend about a podcast I love. Doesn't have to be a friend. Can be your mom. I don't want to get into your relationship with your mom. Could be a good one, could be an okay one. But at the very least, you can either delight her and feel good about it or distract her with some podcast she'll like. But it has to be, hey, let me have your phone. Let me tell you how podcasts work, if that's the state of things, or let me orient you and download an actual podcast on an actual app. So just contact this friend, this mom, this person you care about in real life or on social media, you know, which is like the new version of real life. And if they don't know about podcasts, show them about podcasts. So think of the person in your life who has specific interests that you know of. Think about a podcast with those interests. Ask yourself, does the person listen to those podcasts? If the answer is no, get them to listen to that podcast. And then tell your story again, maybe in real life. This one we don't care about. This part we care about, the social media. Tell your story in social media, like, say, Twitter, with the hashtag TryPod, TryPod. So, you know, got my mom to listen, and now we're actually on speaking terms. TryPod. And thank you for spreading the word.